Hi, everyone, and welcome back to Alien Crash Site. This is our second episode. We have two episodes now. We have gone from a point to a line, and we're growing. This week, we are talking to Ashton Eaton, who is a retired athlete of great renown. He's now working with Intel on some really cool human performance tracking technology, and he is an aspiring astronaut, but we talk about all of that in this interview. I am your hostess, Caitlin McShay, and I wanted to take the opportunity to remind you that these interviews take place over video conference equipment, as does everything in our lives this year. So if you are interested in watching those original interviews, please consider visiting the Alien Crash Site website, which is aliencrashsite.org. You can find all of the original interviews there, transcripts from those interviews, and some bonus material. Plus, everything that's referenced in all of these episodes is linked in the show notes below. If you haven't already taken the opportunity to listen to episode one, I would highly encourage you to do so. In episode one, we interview David Krakauer, who sort of lays the whole project out, as he should, since this was his idea, as was Interplanetary. So if you want a little greater context as to what Alien Crash Site is after, I think you'll find that in episode one, and we just kind of tease that theme throughout the rest of these interviews. But exciting news is that now that we have two episodes, we are available on most streaming applications, so you can subscribe on Apple or Google or Simplecast or Spotify or anywhere you get your podcasts. So please, please consider subscribing as we continue to churn out more and more of these really fascinating conversations. One last reminder, although I'm pretty sure anyone who's listening to this podcast found it through Complexity, but if you haven't already, Santa Fe Institute has another podcast. It's called Complexity Podcast, hosted by Michael Garfield, and it's our more rigorous scientific exploration. Michael takes the opportunity to converse with our researchers and affiliates about the work that they do, and I take the opportunity to work with our researchers and affiliates to imagine and invent alien technology that might save the world. So we are tag teaming to produce content every other week. This episode came out this week, so next week you can check in on some of the research that's happening in real time, and then come back for a little more of the imaginative, speculative side of things at SFI here at Alien Crash Site. So you can find that podcast, Complexity, wherever you find your podcasts as well. And with that, I hope you really enjoy this episode, and thank you for tuning in. We will be back in 2 weeks with Kate Green, who was part of our steering committee for the Interplanetary Project, and had the great privilege of simulating a Mars mission. So that's going to be fun to listen to. Thank you again. Hi. Ashton, how are you?
Doing good. I have Jupiter in my background. Do you have...
I think this is Estonia. It's where...
Pennsylvania?
Close. It feels that way. No, I think this is... So I think that Stalker takes place in a fictional town in Russia, but it was filmed in Estonia. And this is some very scary home.
Nice. I love this.
Yeah? I've never been.
Yeah, I've been there for track and field training.
For training? Is it of higher altitude than I would expect?
Yeah, it's just close to Russia. There was a competition there, so we just kind of set up a home base.
Cool.
Yeah.
And how are you doing in this very weird year?
Yeah, 2020 has been strange, but we are, you know, facing challenges and adapting. And I think overall we've been good. We have a 7th month old son, so he was born in January. On my birthday, actually.
On your birthday.
Which is really funny. And then 3 months later, we had all these grand plans for him to kind of like go to play dates and learn how to swim and all this other stuff. Or 3 months later, yeah. And that all got shut down. So, you know, we've been at home with him and adjusting to that life. Also looking at moving soon.
Right.
And doing some interesting projects at work. So,
yeah. So good. It seems strange, but to have a baby in this time is almost like forced isolation training for a future space exploration. Maybe he'll be very well equipped when the time
comes. That's what I was thinking too. I was like, you know, in some ways this could be beneficial.
right.
Yeah.
So let me take a moment to introduce you and the podcast, or whatever this is. This is Alien Crash Site. It is a new interplanetary interview series from the Santa Fe Institute. I am Caitlin McShay, and you are Ashton Eaton. And for anyone who's listening who doesn't know Ashton, I'm going to give you the impressive bullet point biography.
Oh, no.
And correct me if I'm wrong about any of this, but I think I'm close. So Ashton is a former professional athlete. He retired in 2017, is that right? Prior to that, he competed in the Olympics in Beijing in 2012. He competed in the decathlon, where he won gold and broke the world record.
Yeah, London 2012.
Was it London 2012? And then... Sure. Beijing, were you not in Beijing? I knew you were
in Beijing 2008, London 2012, and Rio 2016.
Okay, so 2012 was London. Sorry, see, this is what I need you.
That's
Rio de Janeiro 2016.
Yes.
Ashton competes again, also in the decathlon, beats his own record, gets a gold medal.
That's right.
retired in 2017, and in 2019 became the first human being to two-time back-to-back Interplanetary Festival panelist.
Yeah, which is awesome.
Your crowning achievement.
That's my crowning achievement. Yes, it is.
For sure. No gold medal associated, but good times.
Yes.
So Ashton has been involved with the Interplanetary Project basically since its inception, but you started becoming involved with the Santa Fe Institute before I even worked there. Mm-hmm. Could you give me a little background as to how it is that you found your way into our very strange and wonderful community?
Yes, and it's strange and wonderful it is. I was on a plane going to a track meet, I believe, in 2016. And at the time, I knew that was going to be my last year in sport. And so I had been reading a bunch of things that were just interesting to me. And they kind of, you know, were on the topics of science and technology and just interesting questions about like systems. I think I read a book called General Systems Theory, and I have no idea why I found it interesting, but I did. And so I was listening to this podcast, or I downloaded something for this flight. And I can't actually remember exactly what it was, but the person that was getting interviewed was David Krakauer. And he started talking about basically the scales of things and how if you take, you know, something like a mouse and scale it up to an elephant, there's all these fractal relationships and you can kind of extrapolate things from that in any range and really understand like what that system is about. And I was like, man, that is super cool. And so I think at the end of this podcast, they were like, you know, tell us about where you're from and how, you know, people can look at your research. Said Santa Fe Institute. So as soon as I landed, I went to the site and I just cold emailed, I think, David. And I was like, you know, I'm an athlete. I'm going to retire soon. I listened to your podcast. I thought it was really cool and interesting. And I'm interested in that stuff. You know, I'm a gold medalist now. And then that's basically it. But what are you working on? And can I be a part of it? And so he said, absolutely. And the next thing I knew, I was coming to the Interplanetary Festival.
Sweet. That, I mean, that was perfect. That's also brazen, I think, a cold call, a cold email.
But yeah, absolutely.
Certainly qualified, that's for sure. Had you had any involvement in our limits to human performance research?
Well, that's actually what he brought up in that initial call. He said, look, I think it's really cool that you're calling, and we don't care about people who don't have experience with like math and science. We just really like this, you know, cross-pollination and ideas from other folks. We have this program called the Limits of Human Performance. We want you to be part of that. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, every time that has been on offer every year, at the time I wasn't able to make it because I was doing something in sport, but I know of it and very much would like to be part of that in the future for sure.
Yeah, I think that the plan is to continue on, but as with everything, the meeting which is probably supposed to be taking place this week or earlier, like a summer meeting.
It's always in the summer.
Is once again, displaced, but we'll get back to it. And it's a nice kind of synergy with what we explore with Interplanetary, just because if you think about the way that there are limits to human performance, I've come to understand that more when I think about what we've learned in long durational flight impact. Yeah. And so it just seems like a perfect little unity. And that's why they often interact and overlap. So if this is kind of an interplanetary proxy, but if we get back to the real world festival iteration and you come back for a fourth time, inevitably, maybe it'll be at the same time as that meeting.
Yeah, I think that's really the benefit of Santa Fe, and what really has drawn me to it initially is, you know, I was a decathlete in this world of sport, and a decathlete by nature is kind of a generalist. And so you touch every single kind of movement, if you will, that a body can undergo as an athlete. And that's what I think Santa Fe does. You take just ideas from so many different areas in order to fundamentally accomplish your goal of studying complexity and learning more about that. But I just think that concept and mindset lends itself to learning so much more.
Yeah, I think that's really well put. I would argue, though, I wonder if in the realm of specialists, you are a generalist. Like, I think it's quite spectacular to find yourself in the professional, you know, echelon that you do. That's but fair. Then you happen to have to do 10 diverse things to succeed. Yeah. He just has to jump high.
Yeah, I never thought of it like that, but that's true.
So you've got a bit of both. And I think that's really good because you apply it, I think, pretty broadly to a variety of things that we've talked about in past interviews and meetings.
Absolutely.
Are you still considering a life in space?
Yeah, so right now I work at Intel, and I'm a product development engineer for whatever that's worth. But I think what's really cool is I'm working on sports performance, which in some sense is human performance products, as I'm going to school for a form of engineering, which I believe right now will be mechanical engineering and robotic systems. And the reason for that is because my opinion is that the future of us off planet is going to take mechanical and autonomous systems. And so if I'm not physically going myself, you know, assisting the future people who will by setting up whatever things need to be in those extreme environments, that, you know, that's that would be cool.
Yeah, totally. And so
And it fulfills a requirement for being an astronaut, by the way. You have to have an engineering degree. Now they just upped it to a master's, I think, to reduce the 18,000 applications they were getting down to like a manageable number. But yeah,
that's a quick filter. That makes sense. Just one one more degree of difficulty.
Yeah.
And so, but in addition to, I guess, your kind of shift from sport to science interest in this new work in mechanical, I didn't realize you were doing a mechanical engineering degree. Congratulations.
Thank you.
That's really cool. Is there something about your athletic past that also primes you towards space exploration? I mean, aside from your physical prowess.
Yeah, I think there's a really strong argument for a sport approach, a sport maybe thinking kind of framework to any kind of really situation that requires a human to push themselves or adapt to a challenging situation. Mm-hmm. So the nature of sports, at least the nature of what I did, was you have to basically try to push yourself beyond what you think you can do. And how do you go and challenge these limits? There's certain mental aspects to that. There's certain training associated with that. There's just like a lot of components that lead to success in that venture that I think would lend themselves to leading to success in a similar venture from like a humanity perspective.
Wow.
So if we need to like send people to the moon and set up permanent bases there, you just have a lot of questions and a lot of, you have a lot of questions that need answering, but if you've addressed something similar, like you have some kind of framework of approach, I think you'd have a little bit more success or make more progress. So I am biased. And I also, you know, I just think that maybe that's true.
I think that's great. I wondered, I mentioned in my email to you, I've been thinking about you because of how world galvanizing in a positive way something like world sport competitions are, and COVID like has ruined everything, including something as robust as the Olympics. I think it's delayed, not canceled, we hope. But I feel as though there's something like what takes place at the Olympics that builds for everyone this human planetary spirit.
For
that's
sure.
Similar to when we're watching a man land on the moon, or if aliens do contact us. And so those seem very kind of connected for me. And I wonder if that is the same for you, or if that's why it seems like such an easy transition to go from gold medal, like competitor to space explorer for our future.
I do. I think you're right on. I think it's very astute because when I was younger, the Olympics was all about just sports and medals. But as I got older, I realized that this thing that we created as a species is like about so much more. It's about bringing the world together peacefully to celebrate human performance and human stories. And the beautiful thing about it is, every country and every race is basically involved. And one of my favorite places at the Olympics is the Olympic Village, but specifically the dining hall, because isn't it like the picture of a peaceful future where everybody's able to dine under the same roof, right, together? And that's the place. That's where it happens.
Yeah.
It's like the only event where it happens. Maybe like at the UN maybe something like, you know, the World Economic Forum or something, but it's just awesome. And so I think the Olympics is very much about that, being a symbol for that. And to make that connection from that to other things outside of that, like space exploration and just science in general, I just found it very easy because I thought the reason for pursuing these things is for that human connection, togetherness, and like what is life about? You know, what is it about what we're doing and where we're supposed to be going?
Yeah. Can I ask a semi-related weirdo question?
Yeah, obviously. Yeah, of course.
What's the weirdest thing you've ever witnessed in the Olympic Village?
So it's not like one particular moment, but the weirdest thing is, and it makes sense, so I don't know how weird it could be, but at the Village, there's just like apartments, right? It's a massive apartment block. Mm-hmm. And basically every country, if you're a massive country, you take up one apartment building usually. So like the whole US team takes up one building. Mm-hmm. Smaller countries or countries that have like less athletes there, they'll have an apartment, like, but maybe they'll only take up a couple of floors. But long story short is these countries and these athletes from these countries, they make that room or set of rooms or building like a mirror image of their country. So if you go into the building that has a lot of African nations in it, it's like the heaters are all on. You know, it's like scorching hot in there. You can barely breathe. If you go into the Japanese team's building, it's like, did you guys just get here? Did you bring anything with you? It's like spotless. Where is everything? And so it's just like one of those things where the building takes on the character of the culture. The Australian building always has like, chants and some parties going on. It's really cool.
What's the characteristic that's minimally reproduced for the American building? Is it like grills and burgers?
That's a good question. Oh, there's flags everywhere for one.
Right, right.
The whole You'll building is an American flag. it's a good question. I think there's, I don't know. I'd call it just like a subdued confidence, if you will. You oftentimes, when you're a young athlete, you're told, okay, look, when you have that American uniform on, you have a target on your back, everybody's looking up to you. This and that's just like that mindset, which yeah. We don't know if it's actually true or not. Maybe not these days anyway, but you kind of like try to walk, you know, with your chest a little higher.
That's right. Maybe it's also like, it's a feedback loop, and because you're walking with great confidence and posture, you're just more intimidating as a competitor.
Absolutely.
That's done pretty well.
Yeah.
It's great. Okay, so we are going to jump into the main crux of this conversation, but before we do, can you tell me a little bit about the work that you're doing at Intel? You mentioned it's sports tracking, athlete tracking, but can you give me a little more than that?
Sure. So basically, we are, the question is, how do athletes improve? How do we help humans improve performance? And generally, today, the way that athletes do that is through two methods. One is they'll do an attempt, and then they'll get a feeling in their body, right? And then with that attempt, they'll also have a coach give them feedback. And then they'll kind of have what the result is. So they take these three data points, three data points. When you do something, how did it feel? What did the coach say looked good or bad? And what was the result? So if you shoot a basketball and it goes in and you're like, that felt pretty good. And the coach is like, yeah, that's right. And that's like a strong connection, right? If you shoot and it's bad and it doesn't go in, like you kind of get the picture. But what's missing and how we improve is basically like, coach, was that good? Yeah, that was good. Cool, it went in. Like, let's keep doing that. How athletes get faster is really the same thing. Do a block start, do a run. Here's how it should be. Move your arms, this and that. How'd that feel? And so amazingly, we've gotten to this level just by feel and intuition. And I think the hypothesis is, how do you get to the next level? Extracting out exactly what the body is doing. So we use cameras, aim them at athletes, and we're able with computer vision and artificial intelligence to pull out exactly what the skeleton is doing. And so you can know when you're running, what was my velocity? What was the angle that my leg made relative to the ground? How are my arms and legs correlated? Because each one of these key points, like, imagine an elbow, a shoulder, a knee, an ankle. Over time, they're just data points in a spreadsheet. And so you can basically know exactly what you're doing. And now you can say, here's what I'm going to try to do, run faster. I'll do an attempt. I'll get the feel. I'll get what I actually did. And I'll get what the coach said. And I'll get kind of the result. And so if you do attempt one, and it's like you run 10 meters a second, and the coach says, change your leg pattern, and that should make you faster. You can make that adjustment, and now you'll know, did I actually make that adjustment, and was I actually faster?
Right, as opposed to the might have been arcane system where you believe that you make an adjustment, perhaps it's not perceived by the coach, and no change is actually manifested.
Yeah.
So it seems like a really clever way for athletes to very minutely calibrate for improvement. So sure. it's for personal improvement.
It is. It's like, how can we help people, again, answer that question, what are we capable of? And the only way to do that is to keep pushing the limits of what we are capable of. So if 9.58 is how fast a human has run today, how do we get to 9.57? And can we? And so helping athletes extract that information on what is contributing to their speed, as a simple example, is what we're trying to do. And I think there are so many subtle things that are happening just in a 100 meter run to an athlete that they could articulate. Nobody kind of really asks, but there's a misstep here. My head's too far back there. And you just like, you don't see them with a naked eye, but you feel them. And we're hoping that with our accuracy, we can kind of pull some of those out. So now they can connect with what they feel and actually see it on a graph or some kind of visualization and be able to make the correction.
And it's continuous visualization. So you can see like over the course of a 100 meter dash.
Yeah, I think that's the most intuitive way to visualize it for sure. Absolutely.
Cool. That's really cool. Is it an application? Is it being used?
R&D.
Okay.
So we're testing in-house and we're confident that we can create something in short order that would be beneficial, but you have to start somewhere.
Right. Seems like there are good athletes to test it on in-house. Exactly. That's so bad. That's great. Exactly. That's really cool. Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay. The hard question. I should give some context to our audience.
Yes.
This is all new and weird. So the premise of Alien Crash Site, not surprisingly, is David Krakauer's idea. And it takes, it borrows from this plot of a Soviet science fiction book called Roadside Picnic that is post-visitation. There is a visitation that leaves a certain area where the aliens once crashed very strange, protected, and full, like littered with new objects, strange, unearthly, unhuman, weird, strange objects. So there are these stalkers that invade. I might edit all of this up. Just like write it up in my podcast thing. I have a better version of it in an email that I wrote to you that I should probably be reading. But theoretically, there are stalkers that enter into these zones, either illegally for sale of these objects to the black market or surreptitiously for an institute of extracurricular cultures that's examining them. And the reason is because some have been encoded or decrypted by humans for the betterment of society. Whether that's perpetual motion or just a new technological advancement. Right. But all of the individuals who spend prolonged time in the zone suffer dramatically, whether it's physical impairment, imprisonment, or even death. So Alien Crash Site asks all of our favorite people the following question. At the risk of imprisonment, great personal harm, or death, what object would you, Ashton Eaton, hope to discover in the zone and why?
Right. The thing I would hope to discover straight out is a device called the Ansible. Now, I actually did not have to think hard about this, and it just came to mind as soon as the question was posed. So to give some context and background, the Ansible itself was a term that was coined by a science fiction writer. Her name was Ursula Le Guin. And it's a play on the word answerable. And basically, it's not necessarily a new concept, but this word is the new kind of version, if you will. But the idea is instantaneous communication all over the universe. And so it's called sometimes superliminal or hyperwave, which basically just means faster than light. And the reason I would want to risk everything to get this sucker is, I think there's a few reasons, but one is, from a practical standpoint, if we are like expanding into space, communication is obviously fundamental to our way of life for many reasons, just on Earth. And we can already see little instances where when something takes too long, we get like frustrated. You know, we were just like, dial-up was only 20 years ago. And here we are, like, at a moment where you can get speed of light communication. But if for some reason, if something takes a little longer, you're like, ah, this thing is like so ancient. Why can't we have like 5G or whatever it is already? But more than that, it's if we're going to expand beyond Earth, it takes information. If you're going to send a message to like Jupiter, let's say we have some outpost on a moon out there, it will take you basically an hour plus round trip to talk to somebody. And so what happens when you have to do that is you basically have to divulge everything you want to say in like one communique and then wait to get back your answer. But I just feel like if you keep extrapolating out, like us expanding, what eventually happens is if you can't communicate with somebody right away, you eventually just, the cord is severed. Like you lose touch. Like there will be totally new cultures, totally new knowledge, totally new everything that we, like on Earth, might not know anything about or learn about much later. It'd be like old news, right? And I don't understand how we could actually have some kind of galactic, you know, civilization without, without this like instant communication device. Because even like to get across to the nearest, what's it like, Proxima Centauri Proxima B or something, is like the nearest exoplanet.
Right.
It would take like 27 years to send a message, at light speed. So that's just there. That's like not counting back. And so just in order to do this, I think we need instant communication, and the Ansible is the thing that would drive that home.
See, that's a funny answer, because if there were an Ansible in the zone, it would almost devalue the plot, right? The mystery of the visit. If there was some miscommunication between these aliens who had nothing but a complete lack of interest in humans and were literally on the planet, suddenly the Ansible would relate the human to that visit, and we would know for sure that the aliens didn't care about us, but at least we'd understand that.
The reason I think this Ansible would actually even be at this crash site is because if they are that advanced, like how are they sending the information back to wherever they're from in any kind of timely fashion, you know, if they're just kind of like out exploring in the universe? Like, I feel like they would actually have to have, some device like this in order to communicate, unless it's just like, look, they've got their own little world or like set of, their own little solar system that they chill in, and everything outside is that is like, we don't care, and therefore they don't need it. But that would mean they'd have to be close to us.
And it doesn't seem like they are.
Right.
If we're just a stopping point to a much more sophisticated location.
Yeah.
And so it would also sort of imply that this Ansible, which is the greatest thing that could happen to us, humans who seek to communicate instantaneously across the universe, would almost be multiple and expendable if they're just like leaving them behind.
Yeah, absolutely. I think Ursula's use of Ansible required that one system, the broadcasting system, had to be connected to a large mass, so like a planet, but any receiving system could be anywhere else in the universe. And so, you know, how the broadcasting and receiving works is like all sci-fi, right? But this notion of, again, I don't know, I just think it's kind of interesting and important, because when you think about, it takes, 8 minutes or something or maybe 10 minutes or something to get a message to Mars. Mm-hmm. And it just seems like unreasonable to think that we would know anything about any other people that we send further out.
Right. Does Ursula describe the actual object of an Ansible? Does it have an appearance or a form?
That's a good question.
Recognize it?
That's actually a good question. So I didn't read Ursula's book in which she introduced the Ansible, mm-hmm. But I read another novel that used her, use the Ansible as that device. So the book I read was actually the Ender's Game series.
Yeah.
And at the time we had, I think it was actually maybe Ender's Shadow, but basically, you know, we're on Earth and we had sent spaceships way out into somewhere to do a pre-entry attack on the alien species. And in order to control those ships that were like light years away, we had to have the only thing that made it possible to do that was this Ansible that we had found from the initial first invasion of these aliens. So they had it on their ship, and that was the only thing that allowed us to like even leave Earth to do anything practical, outside of like our own solar system. And so they didn't really say what it looked like, but they just said it was, you know, the key to this mission.
There are two challenges that I can imagine. One is, let's say you survive and you bring this to the Institute, in this case, perhaps the Santa Fe Institute, and suddenly we have an Ansible in our clutches. One, we would have to figure out how to activate it with the assumption that we would be able to immediately utilize whatever receivers there are, science fiction technology aside, right? That is almost like this unseen other half of the device that we would have to understand. And yeah, I think I'd be curious to know, that seems like such a beautiful and efficient form of technology for this sophisticated alien species. I really do want to try to imagine what it would look like such that if you found it, you'd even know what it was, or didn't mistake it for, you know.
So I think some of the premise of this too is like, would this be, you know, this to us is like the biggest deal of all time. And for them, it's just like, oh yeah, you know, that's like a cell phone. As far as what it would, I mean, but the cool thing is we would have this one, right? And it would, you know, assumably like communicate with whatever other one was out there.
Right.
And so I feel like we'd have it in this room and the first thing to do would be like, hello? Like, anybody there? but I don't know. And for some reason in my mind, I imagine something that basically looks like a quantum computer with like a shell over it, and it's kind of just like the size of a speaker, you know, and
it's portable for your picnic.
It's just like, what's this speaker device? And I don't know why, but for some reason in my mind I envisioned you know, it's thinner at the top and almost has like a cone like structure, and just to make it like a solid base type thing, to maybe connect with whatever it needs to connect with. in general, to me it would just be some kind of interactive port or screen or what have you, where it was like voice and maybe text or some kind of other communication that you could send. So you could send voice, you could send you know, text, if you will, maybe images, I guess, as well. But I don't know if like, if they're so advanced, like what would that actually look like? I don't think it would be the screen structure that we're looking at, but I'm also like not a deep sci-fi thinker. But yeah, I think it'd just be like this little thing that's, you know, looks like a speaker and that's like somewhat luminous. Maybe it takes like a lot of power or some kind of interesting power form. I don't know.
Yeah, exactly. How is it powered? What if Earth doesn't have the mineral to power it? We just have this kind of trophy forever untouched.
Well, maybe that's the thing. Maybe it's powered on, again, I have to kind of think about this, but you know, faster than light communication is basically, as far as we know, impossible, right? But maybe there's like something, you know, we don't know everything, and it's kind of like what's after, you know, if you're looking at atoms and protons and then the finer elements of these things, what's after that?
Right. You know,
what are strings and quarks and that made of? Maybe nothing, but maybe this taps into that, but in order to do that, it has to be connected to something, some kind of mass entity, mass and energy prone entity in the universe.
Yeah, and it seems like it would solve two problems. So there's the squishing of time, right? The elimination of the time delay in messaging, which could maybe be exploited for travel as well. Like, wouldn't it be wonderful if there was suddenly some hack to this Ansible that allows for instantaneous travel of physical matter? Who knows?
That would be insane. Teleportation is basically what you're talking about.
Right, exactly. Or
D-Man. That'd be the second device I'd like.
Exactly. If I had two trips, I would have been caught. But then the other thing that I guess is more foundational, so that's hubristic to think that you'd find this and we'd figure it out and suddenly we were getting instantaneously. Let's say we did. We'll pretend like we're not transporting things because it's unlikely. But it seems too that it might act as a sort of like Rosetta Stone. Mm-hmm. Like if it was from another alien civilization, it seems like it would be a huge challenge, like a rival style challenge of communicating with that civilization, if that's where the receptors are, if we're tethered to the other half of that device
for sure,
without knowing how it is that they communicate. So hopefully it would sort of recognize us and do something nice for us, but there would be, I think, a lot of translation work that would come with that, which is,
I think you're right,
a big barrier.
I think the main translation work also with this is like, okay, we have this one, how do we reverse engineer this thing without breaking it?
Exactly.
As soon as we break it, then we're screwed, right? So we were communicating with aliens, or we had this device that, as far as we could tell, actually, how did we even find out it had faster than light communication? I don't know. Maybe there's a big sticker on it. Faster than light communication device. But it was, you know, if we can reverse engineer it, that's huge. Because then we would know why, or excuse me, how they did it, how it's done, which I think would be really important, because that might unlock all kinds of things, you know. We'd get deeper insight into physics, into time,
totally.
into a lot of stuff. So I think that would be like, I don't know. Yeah, I don't know. I think it'd be pretty cool.
Yeah, pretty cool. In terms of kind of context from Roadside Picnic, it's funny, actually, the things that the Institute or the Stalkers have been able to retrofit to their cars, or have been able to figure out at least some new function for, are things that exist in multiples. So there's this item at the end that the protagonist Red is after that's called the Golden Sphere. I imagine it's golden and spherical. Yeah. And it's thought to grant the finder of it any one wish.
Wow.
Who knows if that's the case, but it's a similar, instead of having to come up with the device or the object itself, you could say, bring me an Ansible that we understand, something like that. Yeah. But there's only one, and it's through a very dangerous route. You almost have to sacrifice a partner in order to like satisfy the zone to get to it. Wow. But these bracelets and the like sparks and the empties or all of these other things, which we're closer to understanding, we're able to because we have multiples. So we can risk the reverse engineering. But there's this fragility, like a bomb, when you want to, if you got the golden sphere, you'd almost never want to touch it. And I feel like that's what you're kind of talking about now.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, I'd be super scared to screw it up. I feel like people would just kind of stare at it. And then at some point it's like, well, we gotta take the shell off and look at the inside. But yeah, there's so many risks with all of this.
Right.
It's almost like when we go back in the past and we find fossils, right? There's so much information there that you don't want to lose, even in the slight brushing of something, you could lose, you know, the human history, really. Right.
But then there's a huge trade-off, because there's so much to be gained if you're capable of kind of getting beyond that first layer and learning something that would have been unseen otherwise.
Yeah, I think that's our kind of modus operandi, you know, risk-reward for the human species.
Yeah, that's about it. That's what it is with humans, trade-offs. And never knowing which is the right or where the limitation lies, and hoping that you're making the right decisions when you do.
Yeah.
It'd be nice if it was easier.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, I think for this kind of item in this context, it'd be super important to figure out how to make that other one. Because if you just have the one and you're kind of communicating with the other receivers, if you will, you just want to know how to make your own so you can kind of use it as you wish and make others. But yeah, because like, what if the other side is just, well, we want to turn this off.
Right, or if, let's say we do crack through and suddenly they hear communication, it's like, to them, our DSL noise. Just like,
exactly.
Ignore.
Yeah. Oh, the other thing too is maybe this Ansible, if we could just like, if we're able to kind of make up the thing that we would like to find, also does translation for you, some way or shape or form.
I would hope, but of course, like, I'm really trying to recalibrate, especially now that I'm at part of the Interplanetary Project and at SFI, I'm really trying to recalibrate what I picture when I picture an extraterrestrial species.
Oh.
Because I basically picture like green men, you know.
For sure.
Or I got close when Arrival came and those kind of octopod things, but who knows? It could be inorganic. It could be organic in a totally strange form. Maybe their perception apparati are completely distinct from ours.
Sure.
So you mentioned images and sound. Who knows? I don't know.
I know.
It makes me worried that I'm going to miss the opportunity.
No, this is very cool. Because I think the one thing that we can do, well, we have to work on what we know. And right now we know, you know, there's elements, right, in the universe to some abundant quantity or whatever. And so we can, I mean, as far as my imagination can go to there and say, maybe there's just like they've found clever ways to fashion the abundant elements in that region to do stuff. And so, you know, what's a planet made out of? Like, what can you mine basically from these planetary bodies? And I don't know, did they find clever ways to use like the gases of a planet like Jupiter or something, for example? Can you harness that or condense it into something that's like totally unique? I don't know.
That's a positive spin on it, I think, because even if it's an unrecognizable arrangement of these things we know to exist, there are individuals on this planet who recognize the qualities, like the physical properties of these certain material things.
Yeah.
And hopefully that gives us one step closer to translating the actual thing of it, the object of it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. No, that's really good. Do you think if you entered the zone, would you do so as a criminal stalker or on behalf of the Institute?
Ooh, I would. Yeah, okay. I think I would want to do it as a criminal stalker for the reasons of, you know, I think having a little bit more freedom and not necessarily having to report what I find, but I think I would practically like actually do it for the Institute and through the right path. Yeah. So I think it would just be something where it's like, this seems like the right thing to do. You know, I kind of always try to err on that.
Yeah.
But I mean, I don't know. I think it depends. There's always this interplay between institutions, you know, not to throw anything at the Santa Fe Institute. But I actually don't think they hold to this, but institutions in general are typically slower, right, than the like fast individual or less risk-averse thing. So institutions like have processes and like forms to sign and risks to consider to the people who are involved and la la la. Whereas somebody else is just like in, out, you know, it's like guerrilla warfare or whatever. So I think that'd be the only downside to an institute. It'd be like, look, there's treasure down there, man. We gotta go get it. It's like, well, yeah, but we have to catalog and this and that. It's just like, no, forget all that.
Protocol. So, yeah. No, actually, I think that's a really good point. If you think about institutions in terms of what they're after, especially if it was this institute that might be able to decode the Ansible, you essentially want to take in the greatest minds, the most capable of doing so, but then you bind them with bureaucracy and protocol and whatnot, and it's years.
Sure.
Meanwhile, it's the mavericks and the rogues and the renegades that are running around doing the scary work and might accidentally sell this Ansible for $300 to like the bartender, you know?
Exactly.
And there's no compromise. There's,
I mean, we've seen examples of it throughout history, haven't we?
Of course. I mean, it has trade-offs, but that's the kind of tragic possibility in this.
I think so.
Would most deftly be found by an independent stalker, the criminal kind. But
I think so. I mean,
there was some, you know, exchange, then who knows?
Yeah. I think about the movie Contact comes to mind.
Yeah.
You know, where, so basically they get these plans to build a, you know, time machine or wormhole thing. And
the technical term.
Yeah, exactly. the government or whatever, like, gets their hands on it. And it's like, we shouldn't do this. And then Jodie Foster is like, no, we need to do it. And so eventually they do it. And there's just like, it's just a whole long process. And you're like getting over human kind of inertia of the system to do it. And then I guess it fails. But then this like private person built their own, just like, screw it. And so, and that was the one that, you know, that ended up working and doing the whole deal. So I think that's like a good example of how we might get something from beyond and just like really hamstring ourselves as far as, you know, knowledge advancement or whatever.
Totally. I think that's a really good example too of the care we have to take in the way we approach totally unfamiliar things.
Mm-hmm.
So we got this, you know, these plans or whatever. And I think it was exactly like you said, some private Japanese country or something duplicated the plans. And had they not, someone who was afraid of change literally sabotaged the whole mission, like threw a flag or something at it.
That's right. That's right.
It was like super fragile. It was sabotaged by someone who was afraid of the unfamiliarity.
Yeah.
Yeah. So to maybe harness ourselves a little further in protection against that would be good in this endeavor.
Yeah, absolutely. Yep.
I take it you're not afraid of unfamiliar.
No, I think, I mean, unfamiliar, you know, I don't know. It's like the spice of life. If things are familiar all the time, it just gets kind of stagnant and boring, if you will. Like imagine if we never learned anything new, didn't try to go anyplace new, didn't kind of break any barriers, and it was just, you know, Pleasantville sort of thing every day. It just seems like blah to me. Because the universe is massive. I mean, the universe is old and massive, and we are relatively young and have gone, you know, not very far, like 300,000 miles off of our planet, personally. So we've sent other probes and stuff away. But, you know, it's like when you ask how much more is there, it's almost a staggering question. Like if one of the fundamental questions is like, what's it all about? Why are we here? This and that. To me, the only way to answer that is by expanding kind of our experience and knowledge. That's just it. It's a, you know what I use? I use a video game analogy. I think that's the best analogy. So
I think that's great. I think that's great for our audience.
Bring yeah. So I may have even said this once, but imagine you are set as a character into an open world video game. And all you know is you kind of get a life and there's stuff around, but you have no idea what the objective is. What do you do? Well, initially you're going to be like, okay, I need to survive. And so you're going to kind of explore your immediate environment, maybe like learn what's dangerous, learn what's helpful. Eventually you learn enough to like start building some tools, set up some shelter and like take care of yourself. Once you have that down, you expand your boundaries a little bit and you say, okay, I'm going to go explore and see what else there is. Can't stay here forever. And so you're exploring, da, 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 you learn a little bit more. You see some creatures. As you're doing this, you're like gaining skills and knowledge that are giving you the capability to go even further beyond your boundary. And so what eventually happens as you go along over time is you keep expanding your boundary and learning and building and learning and building. And at some point you're like, you know, you're on this open game and you still have no idea what the objective of the game is. You're like, okay, well, maybe I'm going to go into the sky and see if like there's answers there. And so you advance your capabilities to like explore even that. And you just take this as far as you can go. And at some point you have to figure out like, this may go on indefinitely. Like this could be, learning the objective of this game may be a never-ending pursuit. However, that might actually be the point. Because if you did explore everything in the game, every little plant and rock and thing that was there, and you were, the whole boundary, you're like, I actually am at the boundary here. Game over. You know, it's back to Pleasantville. It's like, okay, well, nothing new, right? Unless, and this is like a closed environment situation. And so to me, the objective of the game is to explore right now.
I think that makes you unique though. I know that there are people, maybe I'm one of them, who in an open world environment would learn how to chop down the trees, survive, get really good and comfortable at doing that and kind of exploit that skill set proximately.
Yeah.
And so it's a misinterpretation of the objective, I think, which is clever in what you just said. How individuals might do so.
Yeah, and I think that's true for a lot of people, and I think that's like not good or bad. But what I think makes interesting is even though that exists, I think what happens is because we reproduce, a new like person or entity is brought into the environment, and when we started here, and then we learned about the tree and the building and such, we're like, wow, look at all that progress. But when somebody comes in and is born here, that is their floor. That's like, oh, this is all not new. This is old and familiar. And so I just feel like people naturally have this tendency to want to, you know, explore themselves and kind of push that level up. And again, for them, they do that and they look back on all the years of accomplishment and they're able to understand that and encapsulate all the work that went into that. But for somebody that's born in 2020, they have no necessarily context, right, of the 1600s all the way up till now, or even from, you know, 2000, or from like 2000 to 2020, the progress that was made. And that, you know, phones, internet, 5G, it's all just like, dude, we've had this. Like, what's the next one, right?
That's true. There is this comfort of inheritance that we maybe take for granted. And you must progress past that. Are you thinking about that? Do you bring that up in light of Evander? Like, are you more aware of that kind of gradated incremental progress?
Sure.
Because you're seeing someone like observe things and eat different things and express themselves.
Yeah, I think, you know, when I look at my son, I think about that for sure. I think it's just kind of like this magic thing where even when I'm gone, there's a bit of me that will carry on and hopefully it's, you know, I guess from a track standpoint, you can think of it like a relay. you just want to, as your leg of the race, you want to set them up for having a good race themselves and really, you know, put them in the lead against whatever competition, you know, we could talk about. But so when I see him, yeah, I see like the potential, the hopeful future, and really trying to make as much progress as possible for his sake, because I want his kind of floor to be like as far as we can push our ceiling.
Nicely.
So, because that's just like, if there is an objective, if there is an end, that's less work that the next generation has to do, right?
Right. Yeah, and wouldn't it be nice if between now and the kind of motor utility phase and Ansible made itself available to us?
Oh my gosh, that'd be fantastic.
It's funny that you bring that up too, the Ansible, because, and I don't know if this is across all versions, but the version of Roadside Picnic that I have is introduced by Ursula Le Guin.
No way!
Yeah, so it's quite a poignant reach. I wonder if the Ansible is maybe her answer to this question too, and you just kind of grokked that.
Yeah, absolutely. That'd be very cool.
That, I think that was quite poignant. I think that's a really good stopping point.
Awesome.
Just imagining what's possible for our future if we think about pushing ourselves beyond the ceiling.
I mean, that's the way that I look at it. It's just a philosophy, right? When you try to make sense of like life in the world, it's like, okay, well, there's so much out there, but in order to get questions answered, you have to pursue them. And to me, this just seems like there's so many unanswered things that the only way to answer them is to go out there.
Right. And I think if you look at our human history too, you see these episodes, and quite often those like ceiling breaking jumps have to do with communication.
Yeah.
I think that's the point.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much, Ashton.
No, thank you. It's always a pleasure to be part of anything SFI and exploring the boundaries, you know, of our thought and creativity and possible, you know, futures.
Well, thank you for saying so. It's always a pleasure to include you in our imaginations and speculations. Because, I think that you are very thoughtful in the way that you approach human future.
Oh,
and I'm under strict directive to tell you that David says hello and he misses you.
Yes, thank you. I was just going to give a shout out to David and the whole SFI team. And I'm looking forward to the day when we're back at the rail yard and kind of enjoying the sun and the company.
Same. I felt its loss this year.
Yeah, agreed.
Yeah, well, have a lovely rest of your week, year, until I see you.
Yes.
And, yeah, keep your fingers crossed for the Ansible.
I will. Absolutely. Thank you, Caitlin.
Yeah, bye, Ashton.
See you.
I should take a moment to do some housekeeping. So that was Ashton Eaton. As was mentioned in our conversation, Ashton has taken part in both of the interplanetary festivals that precede the year 2020. And if you would like to get a little more perspective on his insight on things like team building, psychological control before doing the impossible, what it feels like to prepare yourself for something that has never happened before in human history, whether it's a manned mission to an exoplanet or breaking the world record in the Olympics, you can enjoy those through the panels that he participated in, which we have published through the Santa Fe Institute Press, since it's not possible for everyone in the human world to attend the festival in real time. So for those of you who would like to kind of continue the thought conversation with Ashton, I would recommend that you visit santafepress.org. I'll link it below. And enjoy this very recently published proceedings from our second festival, though Ashton, of course, makes an appearance in the first. And lastly, if you haven't read The Roadside Picnic and you want to continue enjoying this interview series, it's almost mandatory reading. So with that, I want to say thank you all for tuning in. This was Alien Crash Site. I'm Caitlin McShay, and I will leave you with Red's final hope until we see each other again, which is happiness, free for everybody, and let no one be forgotten. Bye, you guys.